Hey, Berto, let's read some listener emails, and let's also do some tougher bluffs. What do you say?
I love it.
Welcome to the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I am a licensed therapist and a professor.
My name is Humberto Castaneda, and I am an animator.
Tougher bluff. Greater anger expressions among Americans was associated with greater health risks. Tougher bluff. Greater anger expressions among Americans was associated with greater health risks. Tougher bluff.
That has got to be tough, because the greater anger expressions probably raise that stress level, and it probably makes you more susceptible to stroke and heart disease.
It's true. It's tough. You're right. Very, very good. All right. Same study, similar idea for Japanese people, not Americans. Greater anger expressions was associated with fewer health risks than for Americans, if that makes sense.
Oh, whoa. I never even thought it could vary like that. I'm going to say bluff. It was still high. Oh, wait, but it was fewer compared to Americans.
That's right.
Oh, okay. I'm still going to stick to bluff. I'm going to say like it was even higher.
It's tough. It was fewer health risks. Health risks for Japanese people. Yeah.
I wonder if they have developed a more quote unquote healthy way to express anger.
Hard to know. The implication is that their anger expressions in the Japanese culture don't create as much stress for them.
In fact, it could relieve it. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe it helps them in some ways.
So one thing I was reading about, actually I was listening to, this idea that nothing stresses us explicitly in our environment. What stresses us is our mental model about what we're seeing or hearing. So, you know, if we see a snake on the ground right now, you and I would probably get stressed, like, oh my God, that's a snake. But if someone's here and they're a zoologist and they know what that snake is and it's not a dangerous snake, they're probably like, oh no, that's just this coral snake. Actually, corals I think are bad, but whatever. You get my point. So maybe the Japanese look at it like, oh, I'm angry. I must express myself because that's how I keep myself from being unhealthy. I'm being very racist there, but you know what I'm saying.
No, it would be racist is, oh, Saul, I am very angry. As a Japanese person, I can make that thing. Well, yeah, but the stereotype of Japanese people is that they don't express emotion, and so this doesn't make any sense.
Actually,
right?
But stereotypes are not great. But I'm thinking the stereotype I have in my head is, oh, soga, da 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 da.
Right? Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. When Japanese people get angry, men, especially in movies and anime, there's this voice that they do. Is like,
yes. Oh, yes, exactly. And so in my mind, they're always getting angry. To that point, it is interesting how language can be deceptive sometimes. I used to listen to my friend is Korean, and he would speak to his mom over the phone in Korean often. And I would hear only one side of the conversation and not understand a single word they're saying. But I always thought there was always some drama happening, because their inflections were always very worried sounding, like, oh, da 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 da. And I can't do it, but like he would get off the phone, and I'm like, "What's wrong, man? Nothing. Why? But you sounded like there's something wrong with it. No, we were just talking about." And it was very interesting, like what I interpreted from my English perspective or maybe Spanish perspective as drama unfolding, right. Maybe just be part of their natural inflections. Or
right.
Something.
I mean, they even have that in English speaking countries. In that some English speaking countries, like I think Canada or certain areas of England, where people ask questions with every single thing they say. So
do they?
Yeah, it'll be like, so I went to America and I had a hamburger.
And so people think, oh, you're asking me a question.
Right. but to them, it's just
a statement.
Yeah, I think it's like a softer statement.
Like, so if you're going to disagree with me, I was just asking.
Right.
So if you're like, you didn't go to America, I'm like, oh, I was only asking.
Right. Yeah.
A toughie?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There are, through research of facial expressions around the world, these researchers came to the conclusion that there are three universal facial expressions that are tied to specific emotions, tough or bluff.
Start over, say it again.
Doing research on facial expressions around the world, these researchers came to the conclusion there are three facial expressions that are universal and that are tied to these specific emotions.
I see. Three universal, meaning that there's not two and not four.
That's right.
There are three. And
our three main weapons are...
Yeah. Are surprise, and guile.
And ruthless disposition.
Yeah. I would say that. So let me try to see what they are. So facial expressions of pain and disgust, or no, say sadness. Wait, there's probably more than three. You have like happiness, oppiness, or you have disgust, and you have pain, and you have sadness. So I'm going to say it's more than three. So bluff.
Bluff. It's true. It's tough. It's bluff. Sorry.
Which are the...
Sorry, no. You're right. You're right.
Oh, I'm right.
You're right. It's bluff. What's true is that you're right. There are more than three. I can't do this. God damn it. It is bluff. There are six. It was anger, fear, surprise, disgust, happiness, and pain, maybe?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but they, you know, there's 43 muscles or something in the face, and they can create, you know, like 10,000 distinct facial expressions. So obviously, it's clear that there's lots of variants that isn't universal, right? But there are these core ones that seem to be, you know, the same throughout cultures.
Yeah, I had a client. I've had a number of clients from Eastern Africa, and there are people there that when they want to say you know how when we're listening, we're like they would actually breathe in. They would go. So tell me a story. Tell me a story.
So I was walking down the pier. Are you okay?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And I was going to go get a corn dog. Okay. By the roller coaster there. The Ferris wheel. Yeah. And so I was walking and I crossed the street. No. Nothing bad happened.
So that's what they do. They breathe in, and yeah. And when I was talking to them, I thought they were afraid or something, like, or
expressing
they were
surprised,
like they were really shocked. And
wait, where was this?
In Seattle, but Seattle. They're from Eastern Africa.
Oh, okay, got it.
Yeah,
that'd be tough. Yeah, because your natural instinct is like, are you all right?
Yeah, are you?
No, I'm not doing anything scary.
Yeah, it's okay. This isn't a horror story. All right, tougher bluff. Overweight teens who have successfully lost weight did it more to impress their peers or please their parents than for their own sake. Tougher bluff. Overweight teens who have successfully lost weight the weight they kept it off for a long time did it more to impress their peers or please their parents than for their own sake. Tougher bluff.
Yeah, I mean, I would see that being tough. It feels like, especially at that age, you probably aren't that concerned yet with mortality and your heart disease and blah, blah, blah. So I could see that as more of a social pressure in those cases. So I'm going to go tough.
Right. That's certainly the stereotype, but it's bluff. It's the opposite.
Oh, really?
Overweight teens who successfully lost weight.
Interesting.
They did it to please for their own sake, for their own health, for their own reasons, internal reasons, rather than trying to impress their peers or people.
You know what?
Parents.
That totally makes sense. And I actually... I missed, it's not that I didn't hear you. It didn't register in my mind that successfully is very different from the initial motivation someone might have.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
All right. Well, let's read an email from a listener. What do you think here?
Let's do it.
Listener Jason says, have you ever covered a show about people with fat issues after they lose weight where they think they're still overweight and how marriage is affected by one spouse being overweight? He also says, great show. Keep up the great work. But he wants to know, he wants us to talk about, where, you know, people lose weight, but they still think they're overweight.
Yeah. So I have a friend who lost a lot of weight. I'm not talking about like 10 pounds. I'm talking about like 100 pounds. I don't know his internal psychology, so I'm not going to speak to that. But I'm going to say that many of us that knew him, when the ones of us that had been seeing him regularly during that period of time, didn't notice the change as much, even though it was such a dramatic change. And when I was shown a photo, like he showed me a photo of him from a year prior. Now, I knew he had lost weight, right? But when he showed me a photo, I just couldn't believe it. I was like, you were never like this big? What the hell happened? On the other hand, people that hadn't seen him since he had lost the weight could barely recognize. And the people that hadn't seen him, that still hadn't seen him, that I had talked to, like I'm like, hey, have you seen this guy? Like he's lost a lot of weight. The conversation was interesting because they still refer to him and talk to him and everything as if he is, you know, still big, even though I'm telling him, no, he's lost a lot of the weight, right? So I can only imagine that mentally, you might have a similar model happening inside of you that just like I didn't notice that things were changing, right? Like you may as personally, even though you might see the scale changing, like visually, you may not notice because it's so gradual, right? So if your mental model is, I am fat, I'm disgusting, you're not going to notice from one day to the next, oh, hey, look, I look great. So maybe day to day, you're like, I'm fat, I'm disgusting, I'm fat, I'm disgusting. It's hard to imagine that one day you wake up and you're like, oh, I'm not fat, I'm not disgusting.
Right.
So I could see that.
Yeah.
It sucks.
Yeah, it's related to something that I experienced as a kid because I was large. I was really tall compared to everyone else. I was like the tallest kid in my class. And we're not talking just like, oh, I was a, you know, an inch or two. I mean, I was like a full foot, maybe more taller than the average kid in my class.
Did they call you the mountain?
As I grew older, and so now I'm 6'1", 6 foot, 6'1". And so, you know, it's tallish, but it's not gargantuan,
right.
You know. And so, but I still see myself as a gargantuan person. In my mind, I'm like a 7 foot tall monster. But in reality, I'm not. And so sometimes I'll run into that, you know, like someone will say to me like, oh, Kirk, yeah, you're an average height or something. You're an average build. And I'll be like, what? Because in my head, I just have this image of myself just being a monster. I mean, when I played baseball, I was, like I said, a full foot. This is in middle school. And so at that time was probably the biggest gap. When I was like 13, I looked like I was 20 years old. Uh-huh. And some 13-year-olds looked like they were 7. Do you know what
wow,
I mean?
Wow, yeah, totally.
And so when I got up to bat, the coach was always like, you know, go back. He's going to hit it out of the park. And so it was a lot of pressure to like,
oh man,
you know, to do really. And when I played football, same thing. Like sure. The opposite coaches would always, you know, number 40,
take him down,
watch out for him, you know. And so, because a lot of sports are by age, not necessarily by how big you are, you know.
That's true. Oh, actually, that's, we should talk about that at some point.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So today, like your friend, I still see myself as this giant, awkward monster when in reality, I'm just an average-sized monster, awkward person.
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned the thing about age, sports. Imagine if boxing was by age, right? Like, here's like a heavyweight, Mike Tyson, battling a little 120-pound, but they're the same age.
Yeah, right. Like in wrestling, they don't do it by age. They right. do it by weight.
Right.
And so.
So that's interesting that you had that. I have a question about it. Did you have a turning point where you, at one point you felt it was an advantage and at one point you felt it wasn't an advantage?
It was almost always an advantage because in sports and in being bullied and in getting sort of kudos, you know, people would be like, oh, Kirk, he's, you know, he's big, give it to him, or he's strong. So
right.
make him, you know, in junior high, I won best body.
Nice.
But the only reason I didn't work out.
It's just because you're tall.
Yeah, it's just because I look like a man. In eighth grade, I looked like a man while a lot of the other kids looked like boys. And so I got best body.
So there was someone like that in my class in Columbia. I had kind of the opposite, or I don't know, opposite. Like my journey in height, I started at the back of the line, like tall, you know, because they would line us up in smallest at the front, tallest at the back of the line. We had to stand in lines in the morning in the field at school, and they would beat us. No, just kidding. They wouldn't beat us. It was just like to line up to go into classrooms. So I started off in the back of the line in the earlier grades. And every year I would get closer to that middle. You know, I would inch my way forward to the middle of the line. Eventually I was dead smack in the middle of the line. But there was this guy who was in my class. So in our year, he was about a year older than the average age, or at least almost a year or whatever, but it doesn't matter. He looked 25 and he was like, and he was starting to act too. So he was like getting a little bit of local notoriety and stuff. So of course he got a lot of attention, but I also imagine it must've been somewhat tough for him because he looked like an adult. And yet here he is like in eighth grade, ninth grade. Now, of course, yeah, sure. No one would bully him. No one would even think to be stupid enough to do that. And I'm sure he got attention, like plenty of attention from girls, although they might have been somewhat intimidated. But at the same time, like the teachers, I could tell, kind of treated him a little different.
Huh.
And not necessarily for good, because like, you kind of expect, you're an adult, you better know this, you know?
Right.
So I don't know. It's a very fascinating thing being being different than everyone else.
Yeah, I can relate to some of those things. I'd say the downside was that I wasn't as coordinated as my smaller friends. Mm. My shorter friends were. I was always jealous of my shorter friends that were extremely coordinated, and they just seemed to move with grace the way that I just seemingly could not. Mm. And I don't know if being shorter would have helped me in that. But you know, that's so saying. It's like, oh, his brain hasn't caught up with his legs, the length of his arms and legs yet.
Totally.
So there was definitely a disadvantage there. And there was also just a disadvantage of just feeling like a monster. You know, I wasn't a normal person. And when you're in junior high, you want to be normal.
Yeah, totally.
And you don't want to stick out. And so I definitely wanted to be shorter. And I would kind of hunch over a little bit, you know, to just seem like to have a lesser profile, a smaller profile. And so once an episode, my cats try to kill each other, and this is that moment.
Oh, my gosh. There they go. Jesus, guys. It's not Mad Max Fury Road. Come on. No. I hear it's fantastic.
Have you heard that the men in the men's movement are upset because there's too much Charlize Theron and not enough Hardy?
I did. I guess I did see something briefly on the Facebook, but
yeah, they're upset because it's an anti-man. I don't know if it's a spoof or what, but it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, they're saying Mad Max Fury Road is anti-male.
Well, yeah, because they're saying it's basically a hidden, it's like they felt duped into watching a feminist movie.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like, see, men are going to ruin the environment and kill us all.
This whole binary thing about men and women just bothers me. It just bores me to death, you know? It's just like, come on, people. Can't you identify with a woman character in a movie? I mean, if she's doing some badass stuff and you're a man, just because she's a woman, you can't identify with her, and you can't revel and celebrate what she's doing.
Not if she doesn't have a penis.
God, this is so dumb.
They should have drawn a penis on her, and then everyone would have been fine. You know?
Yeah.
So I was going to say that when I met you, I definitely had a very different perspective before we got to know each other a little bit better, because you are a very nice-mannered man, you know, and you don't come on super strong to someone or something, and you seem very polite, and also when I met you, it was at a karaoke bar, and you were singing this song, and it was I forget which one it was, but it was a softer song, and you have a nice soft voice. So in my mind, the association was, oh, Kirk, he's such as this nice, you know, soft, nice person. And one day you were telling me you played football, and I was like, what? I just couldn't picture it. I'm like, you were a football player? That's weird.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
You wrestled.
Yeah, I wrestled. I played all sports except for hockey. But when I was growing, if you meet someone from my childhood, particularly in high school, and you ask about me, they'll say, oh, Kirk, the captain of the football team. That's they know me for.
It's crazy.
Even though that wasn't really the way I saw myself, you know.
You're not a stereotypical, what I would see in the movie, for example, of like, that's the captain. That's the airhead, you know, like, bully captain of the football team.
Right, which I would like to dispel that stereotype.
That's what movies show me.
Right, the stereotype of a football player being stupid or, you know, whatever that is just really not true. I mean, all sorts of guys like to play all sorts of sports. And,
right.
You know. All right. Another email from listener Karina. She says, excellent job you're doing, guys. I've been listening to your podcast already for a couple months, and seriously, I've learned a lot. My name is Cora, and I am following a psychiatry residentship in Holland. Next January, I'll be done. Anyway, I think it would be nice, especially for you therapists, to listen to different techniques. Oh, so she wants me to talk about different techniques of therapy, and I would love to talk about that. I think I've done a few episodes on that, but absolutely, that's a podcast idea that I would love to tackle.
Like
but I can't do it right now.
Like song therapy.
Yeah. Another person asked me to provide the references for the different studies that I talk about, and I honor your request in a way, but I won't honor it in reality because it's too hard to fulfill. This podcast already takes me way too much time. I do a lot of prep. I have to set up all the microphones. I have to, like, you know, get all the Tougher Bluffs ready and all the emails ready. And then I have to edit everything and I have to post it. It's all me. And I have a regular job. And this provides me almost no money. By the way, you could rectify that by going to psychologyinseattle.com and donating.
For every donation, we will annotate one reference.
Yeah. So for those reasons, I don't spend the time to provide the references because that would add time. So I apologize for that, but do your own goddamn research, people. It's not my responsibility. All right, listener Jim says, love the podcast. I'm an avid listener as well as an LMFT, or licensed marriage and family therapist under supervision. I have been working with an agency that primarily works with low SES clients or low socioeconomic status clients, several of which demonstrate what we call victim mentality. I would love to hear a podcast on how you have dealt with that and how new counselors can better deal with this type of behavior. Any thoughts, Berto?
So to clarify, is this victim mentality as in someone who feels they're always being victimized in spite of reality, or is it someone who's actually being victimized and now has kind of trauma around that? Or is it both?
Yeah. I just want to point out that I'm having major deja vu because Berto and I actually recorded a podcast in which we already read this email, but I lost the audio because my computer is, you know, has problems. But if you donate, maybe I'll be able to buy a better computer.
This is not how I remember it.
And we completely lost the audio. And so, like, a number of moments in this conversation, I'm like, oh my God, like, we're having the exact same conversation. It's really weird. But anyway, often what people mean by victim mentality, and I don't know if this is what listener Jim is referring to, but often what I hear among people in agencies is at agencies where they serve low socioeconomic status people, these are high stressed families. They're often single parents. They're often single parent mothers, and they're often on welfare, and they have, you know, three or four kids, maybe by different fathers. There might be drug abuse history. The kids are not doing well in school, and there's a lot of stress. There's not a lot of support. There's maybe even health issues in the family, and the families will come in and, you know, for various reasons, like the kid isn't doing well in school, or the kid is running away, or the kid's skipping school, or the kid is getting in fights at school, or the kid is, you know, punched a teacher or something. And then they come into the agency and the mother will say to the therapist, please help me with my child. And what happens is, because there's so much stress and so many different factors that go into why the presenting problem is presenting itself, because there's so many factors, it's difficult to change very quickly. And so what happens is you have all these therapists, and they're often novice therapists because those are the only people that work. In order to get someone to work for such low pay and such high stress, these are typically novice therapists. There are some therapists that have been working in the field for 20, 30 years and they work at an agency, but more typically, it's starting out. When I started out my career, I worked at an agency such as this because I couldn't build a private practice very easily without experience. And I, you know, just didn't have the experience to get better jobs.
It's the McDonald's of the profession.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. Ironically, these are the hardest cases.
Of course.
So it's just, you know, it's flipped around, which isn't fair to anybody. And the solution to this is that we need more tax dollars. That's the bottom line. We just need more funding, and we need to raise taxes. It's just the way that it is. If you want to have quality clinicians, you're going to have to pay them more, and, you know, da-da-da. So what happens is, because these novice therapists are so eager to see change, and they're so eager to, you know, they've been going to school for 3 years, they've been maybe thinking about being a therapist for 20 years, and they finally get their first clients, and they want change right away. And a third of their clients get worse, a third of their clients stay the same, and a third of their clients kind of get better over a period of, you know, 1 or 2 years. And so what often happens is the novice therapists and the supervisors and the staff, there's this sort of us and them mentality where it's like you end up blaming the clients, saying it's like if they just didn't think of themselves as a victim, then I'd be able to like actually help them because, you know, they're resistant. Now, I don't know if this is what listener Jim is talking about, but this is what I've observed, mm-hmm. is that because they're so, you know, naturally frustrated with the pace of therapy, and that challenges their own ego regarding their effectiveness as a therapist, they look to a answer that is palatable, which is there's something wrong with the clients. And okay, well, what's wrong with the clients? Well, they have a victim mentality, and they can't get over the thought that they should be in a victim space, and therefore they can't be helped by me, even though I'm an awesome therapist.
I see. So I was thinking, because that makes sense, is one of the manifestations. I was kind of relating it back to the environment I was growing up in when I was younger in Colombia. As I've mentioned before, it's very violent. It's very tumultuous. There's lots of poverty. And even what we called the middle class of the country, it was really not middle class as we would think of it. You know, it was like what we would call here, like the poor. So in reality, there wasn't really a middle class. And so what happens is, in order to just survive, I think a lot of people kind of clinged, I'm going to sound like Obama now, they kind of clinged to religion, sports, beauty pageants, things like this, right?
That's what Obama said?
Well, he said when things get rough, people cling to religion and guns, right? And he got in trouble for saying that.
Is that recent?
No, it's a while ago. Oh. Yeah. So, so what I would hear, because I would hear the adults talking, especially like my grandparents' age and their relatives and stuff. And I would hear a lot of woe is me. Like, oh, and I just complain. Like, I would hear a lot of complaining, right? But it was almost because there was really nothing they could do about anything. Like, that's kind of the sense I get now. And so it almost was like that valve, that steam valve, like letting off steam. And because the only thing they could do was like, yep, oh, and then this happened, and oh, man. And it felt like me, like they did like take on this role of like they're just victims and there's nothing they can do about it. But in some ways, I think it's because there wasn't much they could do about it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an interesting way to be.
Yeah. If I had a client, and I have, that seems to exhibit what we might call a victim mentality, or the, you know, way you're depicting it, mm-hmm. what I would do is I have two different approaches. Mm-hmm. One is that they have had a lot of stress in their life, and therefore they need someone to listen to them. Mm. If someone is complaining a lot and it seems bothersome to you, it might be because no one's listened to them complain yet. They haven't received any support, right, in their life. And so that would be the first thing I think. It was like, oh, okay, well, I need to spend a lot of time in therapy listening to them complain, mm-hmm. because, you know, we all need someone to listen to us complain.
Right.
And it's one of the things I tell my supervisees. I say, if you don't have someone to complain to every day, then you're going to suffer. You need to have someone that will listen to you complain and vent for an hour or half an hour every day. This is not something you do once a week.
Wow.
Because being a therapist is very stressful. You need someone to listen to you. Huh. And so
that makes a lot of sense. You're listening to so much stress coming your way.
Yeah. And in order to be open to that, you need to be, you know, supported yourself. So that would be the first thought. The other thought I would have is, well, they've learned, there's such a thing called learned helplessness, and it's in social psychology and in psychology, and it's a real studied thing. The idea is that if you grew up in a world in which you were basically helpless, then you don't have this notion that you can help yourself, because history has shown that you can't. That life will just happen at you and there's nothing you can do about it. So as a therapist, how do I help someone to feel as though they have agency? And how do I help them to enact that agency? How do you get someone to feel their power? And the way that generally it's done, and I guess in response to the other email about talking about theory, I'll talk about solution-focused therapy just as an idea. And there's also narrative, but let's role play it. So role play a victim mentality person.
Okay. you know,
and you're a male, and
I'm stuck in my job, and I have this situation every day. My coworker's always yelling at me.
Yeah,
you know, and what I do is I'm an animator, and I have this coworker who also animates, and he's always yelling at me, and he's always blaming me for things going wrong, the animation's not getting done in time,
yeah.
And every day, and then my boss thinks it's my fault too, yeah. So everyone's just mad at me.
So it feels as though it's a helpless situation.
Yeah, and I can't leave this job. You know, I need the money.
Yeah. So you feel kind of trapped.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you. So in general, you often feel that way. You often feel helpless. You often feel like there's nothing you can do. But tell me about a time when you were able to have some hope, or when you were able to affect change.
Well, when I first came to this job, I had actually left another bad situation, and I felt really proud of myself that I left, but that was different, you know. That was
different. So let me
I was younger then.
So tell me about that. So you left a job because you wanted to improve your life. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and I was younger, so I had less to lose.
So you had less to lose. What did you do at that time? When you know, what was your mentality and what did you do to improve your life?
Well, basically I was actually realizing that I was getting a little bit of a health issue happening with, you know, my bowels. You know, I was getting a little bit of irritable bowels because of the stress level. And so I decided that, I needed a change, and I kind of felt like, you know what? No job is worth my health in this case. Mm-hmm. And I have nothing to lose here. And so I'm just going to go quit, and then I'll find something else.
I see. Yeah. So in that moment, you thought, you know what? I have a health problem.
Yeah.
And this job is making it worse. Is that what you're saying? And I don't like this job. I want to make my life better.
Yeah.
And you must have had hope in that moment. Otherwise, you wouldn't have done anything, right?
Yeah, although it was kind of like, you know what? I guess the hope was that I'll figure something out.
I'll figure something
better
out.
Than this.
So you were saying, I'll figure something out, yeah. and I'm going to start looking for another job,
right?
One that will not irritate my bowels,
right?
And you took action,
right?
And you did, and what a great thing you did! I mean, that is a leap of faith,
right?
That you took that takes a lot of strength and a lot of determination.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure there are a lot of reasons why you shouldn't have done that at
That's
the time.
True.
You're
That's
thinking,
true.
Oh, you shouldn't have done. But you decided. You took life by the horns and you did it. Okay.
My friends were warning me not to quit at
right.
the time.
So end scene. So you notice that, so in solution-focused therapy, what I did there, and everything I said was genuine. It's not a manipulation.
Right.
That's the idea. It's like you're not trying to manipulate the client.
Right.
You're just asking in a particular area. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I did was they call you ask for exceptions. Mm-hmm. So someone comes in and they have a problem and they say, my life sucks and I can't do anything.
Right.
And life is hopeless and I'll never amount to anything. And so the first question I asked was to ask for an exception to that. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So generally, and I language it in a certain way. Instead of saying always life is hopeless, I said generally. I inserted that mm-hmm. language to introduce the idea. This is a brief therapy. This is a Milton Erickson thing. This is, you know, and so I dropped that word in generally. You didn't say generally.
Right.
You said always.
Right.
But I know that's not possible, that it's always that mm-hmm. bad. It can't always be that way. So I said generally. So I'm valuing what you're saying, but I'm wording it differently. It's also a narrative therapy thing. I'm changing the narrative. Generally speaking. And then I said, so tell me a time when it wasn't that.
Right.
And then, you know, you were an easy client. You easily came up with something. Other clients might have a harder time getting to an exception to the rule. But we got to that exception, and then I highlighted it. So, and I noticed you were trying to bring it down again. You were like, well, yeah, you know, it was probably a bad show. But I kept kind of avoiding those negative statements and kept you in the zone of what you were doing well. And then and then we expanded it. And then I complimented you on all the strengths that, you know, undoubtedly
right.
must have played a part in your ability to change things for yourself, all with the idea of look at how you can change your life and look at what you did and
right.
look at how you solved your problem. So instead of me as a therapist saying to you, you need to stop having a victim mentality. You need to be more strong. You need to have hope. I never said anything like that. Never That's did right. I tell you that you need to do something. And this right. is a trap that a lot of therapists fall into because they see the answer and they just want to bludgeon the client over the head with it.
Ah.
And the postmodern therapies, the brief therapies, strategic, Milton Erickson, solution-focused, narrative, collaborative people, solution-oriented people, they switch it around and they say, let's find it in the client. Let's find that solution because the solution exists in the client. We just have to find out where it is and emphasize it. And then when they walk out of the session, they feel more powerful. They have their own answer to their question.
They have a tool they can use.
That's, right.
Yeah.
And they have a mindset they can use.
So you're like Chris Angel, mind freak. You're like, just freak my mind. No, but that makes sense because it's the, and like you said, the language that one has, and I've gone through this, not literally with this scenario, but I've gone through this in my own therapy that I've gone through, where I come in with a specific narrative and it feels, and you know, when my therapist challenges me or inserts, like you were saying, different words into that narrative, it oftentimes at first feels invasive to me because I'm like, no, I'm doomed, you know, like, oh, no, it is always. And it's sometimes hard, like, to like consider that maybe the narrative is part of the problem. But like what we were saying before about how stressing factors might come from the, you know, like stressing factors come from the outside, but it's your interpretation of those that makes it stressful. It's kind of a similar idea that your narrative is how you narrate to yourself about what things are to you.
Right.
That's very powerful.
Right. So if your narrative is that you're a victim and you can't do anything in the world, then that's how you're going to live your life. The other thing I'll point out is that if the client feels as though they are resisting what the therapist is doing, in solution-focused or narrative therapy or collaborative therapies, brief therapies, you failed as a therapist. You shouldn't kill yourself. But the whole idea of solution-focused therapy is it should never, or should very rarely, it should feel as though the therapist has an agenda. Like when I was talking to you, if you started to present resistance, it's like, well, okay, Kirk, I see what you're doing. You're trying to make me look on the positive. I would say, oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe I was, you know. So because the solution-focused postmodern collaborative folks are so pure collaborative that you would never, as a therapist, try to make the client do something. And if it was ever, if you ever gave that vibe as a therapist, it instantly makes it not solution-focused therapy. There's this other form of therapy called motivational interviewing, or it's a technique in therapy, and it's often used in chemical dependency. And the motivational interviewing people do pretty much the exact same thing that solution-focused people do, but motivational interviewing people, they know the answer to the question. So solution-focused people, they don't know. So you would have to say, I have a problem with my ability to get things done. And then I would say, would you like to work on that? And then we'd say, okay. And then we'd move forward.
You wouldn't form a theory about what you think is wrong with it.
Right, exactly. And non-post, what they call postmodern or collaborative therapies, they tend to have the therapist derive at times the problem, you know.
It was the mother's nipple that he didn't get enough of.
That's right. That's your Austrian accent.
That's my Austrian accent.
Yeah. Whereas collaborative therapies, they would never do that. Whereas motivational interviewing, they do. So in chemical dependency, often the, you know, chemical dependency counselor, they know that the client needs to stop using heroin, for instance.
They know. Okay, got it.
They know.
Right.
If the client said after 10 sessions, you know, I'm cool with using heroin. I'll just keep it at a certain level and I'll make sure I'm safe. CD, chemical dependency people would never say, oh, that's fine if that's what you want to do.
Right.
But they will use motivational interviewing in a solution focused way. I'll role play motivational interviewing. You use heroin every day and you don't want to be in session with me. And you just sat down. So, but we've had a couple sessions, so we're not completely.
Okay.
Yeah. So how's it going?
Fine. I've actually been better than I felt in a long time.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And your heroin use, how's that going?
So I kind of found like a happy medium, to be honest.
Yeah.
I kind of figured that I don't like quitting altogether. What happens is I just get too stressed for that. I actually kind of feel sick. And we obviously know that I just can't keep doing it the way I was doing it. But so like I'm kind of keeping it on like this nice balance.
Okay. So you're finding balance and you're able to reduce some of the negative effects.
Yeah.
That you had
in the past.
And you're happy about that.
Totally. I'm feeling great.
Right. Yeah. Well, but you also said, did I catch that? You also said that you, there are still some bad things. Is that what you said?
Well, I mean, like everyone's got bad times and stuff like that, but I'm just saying, like, I'm having, like, you know, people aren't finding me, like, you know, passed out in the bathroom, like, you know.
Great.
And I feel good, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's quite a success. It takes hard to do, and you've really, you know, pushed yourself hard to reduce your use, and you've found a lot of success. That's great. Good for you.
Sweet.
Yeah. Okay, I'm not very good at motivational interviewing, so where do we go from here? Let me think. So if there were negative effects to your current level of use, what would they be? If there were?
I just, like, every time in the past, like, it's more about, like, you know, it can affect my relationships. And, as you know, I lost one job because of it, but that's when I go too far. Like, you know,
right.
It's really all up to me to, like, just not go too far.
Right. I see. So it's up to you, which makes, you know, makes sense to have an effect on your use.
Yeah.
To reduce the negative effects of the use.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're okay with your current level of use. That's what you're saying.
I mean, like, sure, I get desires. Like, you know, obviously it's something I enjoy doing, in the vacuum of, like, outside of the negative effects, I enjoy doing it. So of course I want to do more, but as long as I don't, like, I just got to keep it in check. That's the point.
Right.
You know?
Right. So, scene. This is why I don't like motivational interviewing, because as a collaborative therapist, it's hard for me to be in a space where I have an agenda that you don't have.
Right.
where I'm, like, in my mind, I'm trying to get you to admit that you should quit.
Right.
When I don't have those thoughts with my clients. I don't, you know.
I wonder if, because I don't know the background with motivational therapy, but I'm wondering if, like, you were doing earlier with me about, like, tell me about a time where it wasn't, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if, like, asking me, like, you know, tell me about this last week. Tell me what you, how this last week went, or something where I might just start talking and then all of a sudden I'm like, well, and I got in a fight with my girlfriend, but, you know, and, like, that might give you an in or something.
Right.
I don't know if that's
you're right. That would have been a good direction.
Cause I feel like in these scenarios, and again, I obviously have no training in this, but just even from experience with people that have had addiction problems and my own addiction problems with spending money in the past that were actually very, very serious. I feel like the giveaways happen when you get into the details about the day to day. Cause, you know, you'll say, like, how's it been? Oh, great. Like, oh, tell me about this week. And I might have said, you know, I did buy a jacket, but it was, you know, I sold stock. It was fine. You know, it's like you could get to those little bits and then you're like, oh, tell me more about that. And it's like, did you mean to sell stock? Like, I kind of feel like once you get them talking, them meaning the person with a problem, I think if it's really still a problem, the truth might come out through their narrative. You know?
Right, right.
But anyways, now I'm spouting.
No, that's good. Okay, tough or bluff. Police who are at high risk for PTSD, so police officers who are, you know, because of their jobs, they're at high risk for PTSD. Negative personality traits may protect them from PTSD. Tough or bluff?
Oh, yeah. I could see that. I'm going to go with tough because, okay, for example, a psychopath, I would call that negative personality traits. A psychopath would probably not suffer from PTSD because they probably won't, they just won't feel the fear. They won't feel the empathy. They won't feel these things. So they probably won't have the PTSD, but clearly wouldn't want them to be psychopaths. So I'm going to go tough.
Well, it's bluff.
Oh,
it's a poorly designed tough or bluff question. Once I tell you this.
Okay.
I just realized that. So it's positive personality traits that actually protect police at high risk for PTSD. The study examined the association between resilience, satisfaction with life, and gratitude, and in symptoms with PTSD, and found that resilience, satisfaction in life, and gratitude actually protected some police officers from PTSD during Hurricane Katrina.
You know, but that makes sense. I guess I was only thinking about one extreme, which is, you know, like, maybe I am right about my psychopath hypothesis, but if you're constantly dealing with stress and with, like, bad situations, and you don't have a good outlook on life, and you're not easily able to calm yourself and stuff like that, then yeah, that would be worse.
Yeah, worldview, I'm realizing, has a lot of effects on a lot of things. When you go through, when you have a loss, your worldview will affect the grief you experience. Everyone grieves after a loss, but if you have a positive worldview, like the world is a good place, people are good, I am safe, these kinds of things, then it tends to go better for you. Now, it's not always a choice that you make, because if life has not been safe for you in your lifetime, then that is going to make you have a worldview that the world is not safe, right?
That's true.
But it's hard to cope with life and difficulties when you think that the world is a dangerous, horrible place.
And actually, so I'm sure you've seen Seven.
Yeah.
Love that movie. So it's interesting because like the outlook of Morgan Freeman kind of summarized at the end when his quote is, and he's quoting someone else, I forget, Keats or someone, he's saying, the world is...
A vampire?
The world is a vampire. No, it's something like the world is a terrible place or a horrible place and worth fighting for. I'm totally butchering the quote, but the idea was his perspective on life was, hey, I'm aware that reality is really ugly and there's all this ugliness in the world, but I still feel that it's important to live and fight, right? And so it's kind of like that. That's his way of protecting himself, and that kind of keeps him protected from all that horribleness that he witnesses. Brad Pitt's character is way more vulnerable, in my opinion, because he seemed to have this worldview that like nothing can really touch him, you know, like things are good. And you know, this seemed like his first really bad case that he had to deal with. And he was trying to like just rush through it and stuff like this. So that big upset at the end is probably going to shock his worldview to the core. And he might have a harder time adapting from that. Whereas I feel like Morgan Freeman's going to keep on carrying on. Which, so that's my movie analysis of worldview.
So Brad Pitt is going to shoot...
Spoiler alert!
Is going to shoot Kevin Spacey, right?
Spoiler alert, yeah.
He's already opened the box. He's going to shoot the guy who killed his wife. Right. And Morgan Freeman is saying, Brad Pitt, don't shoot him.
Don't shoot him. Morgan Freeman, in spite of how horrible this is, and granted, it's not his wife, but still, he cared a lot for her. He's sitting there going like, I know the world is terrible. But we keep on keeping on.
Tougher Bluff, using a light-emitting electric device before bedtime negatively affects sleep, next morning alertness, and circadian timing. Using a light-emitting electronic device like an iPad or your phone before bedtime negatively affects sleep, next morning alertness, and circadian timing. Tougher Bluff.
It is so tough. Why? And I experience it firsthand quite often, and I need to stop experiencing it. Mm. I end up using my phone in bed right before I fall asleep, and sometimes it falls on my face. Sometimes hard. And it's really bad for you.
Really? So you're holding your iPad above your face, or is your phone or your iPad?
It's my phone.
So you'll be reading it and you fall asleep and it literally falls on your head?
It falls on my face.
You'll fall asleep.
Boom. Ow. All right. I found the quote, by the way. Oh, no, actually, here we go. Here we go. Tougher Bluff. The quote, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for," is by William Somerset.
I don't even know where to begin. Bluff.
Okay, of course, because that William Somerset is the character in the movie, Morgan Freeman's character. The quote is actually by Ernest Hemingway.
Okay.
So the full quote at the end of the movie is, Ernest Hemingway once wrote, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." I agree with the second part. So that's really telling of his worldview, because he's basically saying the world is not a fine place, but it is worth fighting for.
So, yeah. So, people, stop looking at your phones before you go to sleep. It's not natural, and it'll screw up your sleep. I've done it myself, and I don't think it's going to necessarily screw up your sleep, but it's probably not a good idea. And if you're having trouble with your sleep, then this is one area that you might be able to affect change.
Yeah. Well, I had trouble with my sleep last night, and I used my phone right before I fell.
Well, did you have trouble falling asleep?
No, not that. I had trouble in that when I woke up in the morning, I was a mess.
Like you didn't feel
good. I didn't want to get up. I had gotten enough sleep. I didn't want to get up. I felt really like not awake and alert. It took me a while to, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Huh.
And I didn't feel that soreness in my throat that I sometimes feel when I've been snoring, which could be, you know. So I was like, so then I'm like, damn it. Maybe it's because I was on my phone.
You snore so much that you feel sore in your throat in the morning?
Not always, but sometimes. I didn't realize this. It took me a while to realize this because there were times where I would wake up and I'm like, oh, I think I'm getting sick. My throat is sore, right? And then over the years, I realized that sometimes it's acid reflux. Sometimes it's because I snore. And sometimes I'm getting sick. Yeah.
All right, tougher bluff. Parents who use material goods to reward or punish their children may be setting those children up for difficulties in adulthood. Tougher bluff. Parents who use material goods, like toys and this kind of money, to reward or punish their children may be setting up those children for difficulties in adulthood. Tougher bluff.
Oh, my God. Bluff. Because, oh, no, I know it's tough. Come on. Tough because it doesn't give them an inner sense of accomplishment or an inner reward system of like the, you know, the journey is the destination kind of thing. And instead it makes everything about what they're going to get out of it. And so tough.
Yeah, tough. The researchers found that when parents rewarded children with gifts for accomplishing something or to show affection or punish children by taking away something, the children were more likely as adults to believe that success in life is defined by possessing material goods or that acquiring certain products will make them more attractive. You can relate to this because you were talking about how your family would buy your love with stuff and then you became addicted to material things.
Totally. Totally. It's kind of incredible how these things get connected, but they do. Hey, congratulations on that test. Here's your $10, right? But you do it once, maybe it's fine, but you do it repeatedly in many different ways. And then, yeah, you're right. Then later you're like, I'm worthless because I didn't make enough money this year or whatever other problem.
Yeah. Because I talk to a lot of parents as a family therapist. And when I bring up this point, they'll say, so what am I supposed to do? I mean, it's the only thing that works. When I want them to do something, I have to use an incentive. And when they do something bad, the only thing that works is when I take away something. And it's a complex issue and parenting is extremely complex. And so it's not cut and dry, like you should never ever use material goods or money or something to reward or punish people. But the idea is that if that's all that you do, and if did my
cat ow, I got attacked
by the cat.
My hand got.
Yeah. Did it draw blood?
No.
Okay.
My cat, on the other hand, last night jumped up on my foot, bit and scratched with both claws. I had 3 Band-Aids on my foot. It was ridiculous. I was so pissed. Anyways, sorry.
The idea is that the best way to reward children is through approval and by talking, giving them attention, essentially.
Wow.
So, you know, because there's this weird idea in our culture that children only respond to tangible rewards. But when you study people, they are much more likely to respond to social rewards than they ever will to money rewards. I mean, think about things like Twitter and YouTube and stuff. Most people get no money from these activities, but they're highly active on these things.
That's true.
Wikipedia is completely free. People donate their time.
How many likes did I get today?
Right. How many likes did I get? That will get people much more motivated than paying someone money and with no social rewards. And so with children, they're, you know, exaggerations of this to some extent. And so when a child does something well, like they get good grades, if you give them attention and love and accolades and that you're proud of them and that you recognize all their hard work and you praise them, this is much, much more effective to reinforce the behavior than giving them $10.
Wow.
Now, you can give them $10, but you also have to give them all the other stuff.
Right.
If you only give them $10, then you're creating a monster.
Now, what if you give them $100?
Well, that's completely different. I remember growing up, a friend of mine would get $20 if he got an A.
Oh, my God.
And I got straight A's for nothing. And I just remember thinking, my God, I'd be rich. I'd be rich.
So I had straight A envy. Or straight A money envy, because my brother. So my brother,
your own brother.
Yeah, my brother's a half brother, right? So he had a step. I have a stepdad. Yeah. His dad is not my dad, right? Yeah. And so he had a policy that for every A he got, he would give him, my brother, some money. I forget, maybe it was
$10.
Well, because he wasn't my dad.
but you're in the
family. I know. It's bullshit, right? Okay. And for every good tooth he had, he would also get, you know, every time he went to the dentist.
How much money?
I don't know, like $5 per tooth or something. It was a lot of money.
You have like 26 teeth in your
mouth. I know. Or maybe it was a dollar per tooth. I don't know. But he got, all I'm saying is he got a lot of money this way. And I was always like, Mom, what is going on? Like, how come I'm not? And she's like, well, that's him. You got to talk to your stepdad, right? I'm like, what? And so I was always so jealous. But in the end, maybe it was okay. Maybe it was fine.
It's BS, man. I hope you've yelled at him.
No, yeah, because I'm now grateful that I didn't, because I ended up loving getting A's just for the sake of it.
I can hear it. Here's an email from listener S. He or she says, your unbiased assessment of Elliot Rodger allows a person to see Elliot as a human being with severe emotional problems. It allows one to focus on some of the possible factors that led him to commit a horrendous crime without getting wrapped up in the crime itself. So this was in response to our episode.
Right.
We had two episodes on Elliot Rodger, the guy who killed a bunch of people in California a year ago-ish. Yeah. Most other assessments or news media reports online either slight the listener to brutality of the crime before it is revealed or cloud the assessment with either minimizing his paralyzing fears or presenting in such a way that one stops listening to what may have led to his crime because one starts to feel that trying to understand the complexity of his personality leads to feelings of guilt due to the brutality of the murders. Your way of assessing him allows the listener to separate the crime until the last possible moment and listen objectively, very professional and insightful. So I didn't, when I started reading this email, I didn't realize it was just a bunch of praise. But yeah, when I agree, when I would read media reports and listen to, you know, or to and watch news reports of the Elliot Rodger story, it's just interesting how if you just consume the normal amount of media on a story like that, you get a very, very limited picture of what actually happened. And so I decided, I got really obsessed with this story. I said, oh, I'll do an episode on Elliot Rodger. And then it just blossomed into this thing where I probably spent, I'm not even joking, like 30 hours researching and like writing stuff down because there were all these accounts and I was trying to fit together an entire storyline. And then I had to do a lot of analyses and read a lot of personality books and stuff. And so in order to really understand something like this, and I don't even think I really understand it. I just did a comprehensive review. It takes a lot of effort. And what, you know, the things that people pulled away from the Elliot Rodger story when it first came out was misogynist white boy goes on killing spree of sorority girls because they wouldn't have sex with him.
That's right.
Yeah. That was
the narrative.
That was the narrative. And so naturally from that narrative, we get this other story of like people saying, therefore, you know, and people saying, look, you know, if men weren't misogynists, they wouldn't go on killing sprees of sorority girls. And then the not all men thing right. came out where it was like, not all men are misogynist killers and, you know, stop equating. And so, you know, these really simplistic viewpoints just I think miss the overall point of the fact that you had an individual that was suffering a great deal his entire life, was a very disturbed individual and had a very odd way of seeing the world. Yeah. And he happened to be a misogynist, absolutely, and he absolutely had been hurt by women in the past. But pretty much it was automatically going to happen because he was an extremely awkward person. I mean, you know, there's awkward people like nerd awkwardness. He was beyond awkward. He was a very strange individual.
Yeah. It actually minimizes the cause for day-to-day misogyny that affects the broad society by pointing to this one very isolated incident. It's like, see, that's the problem right there. It's like, well, then that would, the conclusion would be like, oh, great. Then actually we've solved it because most men don't go on killing sprees. So I guess we're done. We're done. No one's misogynist, which is obviously the wrong conclusion.
So let's conclude the podcast with a little song.
You and me, Sunday driving, not arriving, on our way back home. We're on our way home. We're on our way home. We're going home.
All right, that does it for another episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining us. And please take care of yourself because you deserve it. And if you have someone that you can go down the road together and burning matches together, then you should do that.
Yeah, that would be very beautiful.